we are on a new journey here as a people, in that it seems like we're going to be heard. The issues that were overshadowed last year by the tear gas and police riot are going to be heard this year. I think every true human almost should be very, very happy about that, because the true issues around the WTO and globalization are in fact devastating. With that in mind, I'd like to hear from someone, or we've invited Sally. She's graciously agreed to help us with some of the facts on WTO. And without further ado, here's Sally.
Thank you very much, Dale. I'm Sally Soriano. Last year, I worked with People for Fair Trade Network Opposed to the WTO. And this was a coalition that came together of Washington State organizations that worked over 9 months. Over 100 organizations worked together to educate the grassroots, to educate the people of Washington State about what was the five-year record of the WTO. We held meetings, we had speakers, we passed around information, what little information there was in print about the five-year record of the WTO. We found that there was only two newspaper articles internationally, one from the London Independence and the other from the San Francisco Chronicle, and we thanked them for researching and showing us what this record, what this organization in Geneva that was approved in 1995 by governments around the world with not much discussion about what was in this record, this five-year record of the WTO. It's an interesting coincidence that right now we have a newspaper strike in this city, the Seattle Times. The reporters at the Seattle Times are on strike. And what happened immediately from management from the Seattle Times was that a fence was put around this park, you know, in front of the Seattle Times, that this was a place that they weren't supposed to go to protest. To protest what? The fact that they felt that they should have cost of living wages. They have security people dressed up in black surrounding the Seattle Times, a problem with asking for higher wages. Workers saying to management that we need a change. We need a change within this newspaper. Our rights are not being met here. And it's a real similar kind of thing that has happened to us not only last year or leading into the WTO demonstrations, but also leading into now these celebratory demonstrations with this demonization going on with newspaper reporters for asking for higher wages, and a demonization for protesters, for people who said, we looked at the five-year record of the WTO, and we find that this system, which was established by corporations, written by corporations, put in by elected representatives, but we don't think really knowing what was in that text, what was in the text of the WTO. It was put into effect in 1995, and its five-year record, when we look at it, shows us that nations' laws have been overturned. These laws that were overturned, number one, we looked at the record, and it said that the European Union could not define its own food. There was a ban that the European voted 360-0 to ban hormone-treated beef. The WTO, this United States, but it was actually the beef industry from Texas that took the issue to the WTO and said that we want this overturned, that the European Union do not have the right to ban our beef that is treated with hormones from the European Union. And that ban was overturned by the WTO. A secret panel. A panel met in secret. There's no conflict of interest provisions with this panel. They don't have to show any of their documents. The press can't look at their documents. Citizens can't look at their documents. And they made the decision after a vote of 360, the entire European Parliament voted to ban European beef from Europe. So we find that in this system of the WTO, that democratic governments, when they enact their laws, these laws are then overturned in this system. Last year in January, this last January, Norm Stamper spoke at the University Unitarian Church, former police chief Norm Stamper, and he said that my sentiments actually were with the people who were in the streets, because a secretive organization like the WTO does not belong in a democracy. And I think elected officials, leaders in this community have said this over and over. This system is a system that is not democratic and does not belong in democratic systems around the world. And that's why last year in the streets there were 50,000 people who went to the streets to say that. And this year that there's going to be a celebration in the streets of Seattle, in downtown Seattle, in the center of downtown Seattle, to say that we still disagree with what has gone on in the five-year record of the WTO, and in this last year, not very much has happened. The WTO has not become more transparent. The WTO has said, has given lip service, said that they, you know, hear us, that they're taken aback that so many people were in the streets, but nothing has really changed. John Conyers from the House of Representatives is saying now that the Congress is going to start looking at the WTO. They're going to question the NAFTA. They're going to question these free trade agreements where, when democratically elected officials from us have their laws overturned in both of these systems. So what we want to do is have a discussion in this press conference, this ongoing press conference all day, about the substantive part of the WTO, about what exactly the system is, what it has done over the last 5 years. Last year, Representative Velma Valoria from our state legislature held a press conference. 27 elected officials from the United States attended that press conference and signed on, raising issues with the sovereignty, with the sovereign rights being overturned with the WTO. A representative from Canada, an elected representative, Bill Blakey, said that, you know, elected officials should just pack up their bags and go home, that they shouldn't even be taking a paycheck because these levels, with both the NAFTA and the WTO, can overturn any law that they put into place. And so he said we should just, you know, just forget it. Right now, this democracy, elected officials, our governments have become facades. I was just up in Canada this weekend, and some Canadians at this conference on the WTO called Doing Democracy said exactly that. They said all of a sudden it's like we're in a Hollywood movie set with this facade of a government, and actually there's nothing behind it. So what we want to say today, all day, is that it's not... What we want to have is one person, one vote. This is what democracy is about, and what the WTO represents is $1, one vote. It's a corporate structure written by corporations. Ralph Nader, who is running for president, said, we can have trade uberalis. Trade uberalis means trade agreements can trump everything. We want to... What Ralph Nader said is we want to withdraw from the WTO. It has a six-month clause where we can pull out and rewrite the WTO with citizens sitting at the table defining what we want to have happen to the environment, what we want to have happen to consumer rights, what we want to have happen to workers' rights in these trade agreements. That trade agreements can deal with trade, but they can't usurp our laws, take our laws away from us. Thank you. Are there any questions? The Uruguay round of the GATT, actually, the General Agreements on Tariffs and Trade, has been a formation for over 20 years. And in 1984, there was beginning the negotiations called the Uruguay round of the GATT. And within those negotiations, corporations began writing in provisions into this trade agreement. Prior to 1995, with the Uruguay round of the GATT had been about tariffs, about goods crossing borders and what the tariffs were for those goods to cross borders. In 1995, when the Uruguay round of the GATT was written, it was written for this structure, which was to be called the World Trade Organization. And incorporated into this agreement was this panel, a secret panel that could meet with three representatives, no conflict of interest provisions, don't have to show their documents or who they are listening to make their decisions. And conflicts could be brought to them by countries. Actually, you know, it's not to call it countries bringing these conflicts. It's actually the corporations having their countries bring these conflicts to these secret panels. For example, France has banned asbestos, and Canada brought that issue to the World Trade Organization, but it was actually the corporation that makes asbestos within Canada that asked Canada to bring this conflict to the World Trade Organization to get rid of the ban in France on asbestos. So 1995, this Uruguay Round of the GATT was brought before Congress, and there was very little discussion. I was the organizer for the state of Washington for stopping the Uruguay Round of the GATT to be voted on in Congress. But because there had been such a debate about NAFTA, and many grassroots organizations, labor included, their treasuries had been expended on that fight, there was very little discussion except 2 weeks before the vote in the Congress on the GATT, and the GATT passed both the House and the Senate and then became law. The first law that was changed was our Clean Air Act. Our Clean Air Act had a provision to prevent dirty gasoline from coming into this country. And the Venezuela, actually the corporations in behind this interest in Venezuela, the petroleum interests in Venezuela, took this dispute to the World Trade Organization, and the World Trade Organization ruled that this provision of our Clean Air Act that protected our country from dirty gasoline coming into this country said that this ban could not hold, and so it was overturned by the World Trade Organization. So that was one provision that we lost. Also, there was a provision in terms of protecting sea turtles from drowning in shrimp nets. The Endangered Species Act, that provision has been in dispute, and there was a decision by the World Trade Organization that we had to let in shrimp into the United States, whether it was protected, had nets that protected turtles or not. So those are two of our laws, and then the European Union lost their law protecting hormone-treated beef. Thanks.
All right, Sally rocks.
Yeah. Now that is usable information. I'm hoping that the media can get the message here. Dig into this. There's a Nobel Prize in there. Guaranteed. WTO bad, sovereignty good. All right. Speaking of sovereignty, next we come with Erica Kay. She's going to talk to us about, amongst other things, the mass filing that we expect on December 1st.
Well, Sally's given us a little bit of background about the reasons that people were out in the streets last year, and I actually want to shift gears just for a moment, and then you'll be going back to talking more about the WTO in particular. But what I want to talk about is my story and the story of many of the people that were both in the streets because of what the WTO was doing last year, as well as the people that didn't know anything about what WTO was about but ended up getting caught up in what happened last year. One thing that happened, well, first of all, I should tell you that I'm here representing both myself and the December 1st Mass Filing Coalition. We are calling ourselves that because on December 1st, we are going to come together again. This time we're going to be coming together to be holding our local government accountable. We're going to be asking our local government to be accountable for the actions that they took last year here in the streets when they unleashed tear gas on the people that were merely out in the streets to let the world know how they felt about the WTO. They brutalized people. They arrested them. But more importantly, perhaps, they intimidated people. They made people afraid, and I've heard from people this year that they are afraid to come and speak out against the WTO again this year because they were made afraid by what happened last year, and they've been made afraid by the posturing of the police this year that they, if they decide to come down, they may actually be arrested. And most people don't want to be arrested for disagreeing with the way our governments work. They want to be able to talk about that, and they want to be able to talk about that in the streets if they need to, or in teach-ins, or in other places. Last year, people were prevented from going to teach-ins because the city put a no-protest zone around a huge portion of the city where their teach-ins were scheduled to be. So the Mass Filing Coalition has been looking at what's happened at the last year and has realized that people like myself who have stories, I have a story about what happened last year. I'm not going to tell you my story, but Scott may tell a touch about his story from last year. People have stories themselves, and we've been telling them all year to each other. We told them to the city council. We told them to the mayor. We told our stories and we asked for changes. We asked for changes just like we're asking the U.S. government to pull out of the WTO or to change the WTO, depending on our perspectives. We're asking for our city to make changes as well in the way they respond to us when we speak out. We've asked for that and nothing has happened. We've gotten reports. So instead of simply asking for changes, we are going to do what is our right. We are going to, those of us that feel we were specifically injured in some way by the actions of the city, we are going to fill out what is called a claim for damages and with the city, and we are going to ask them to compensate us for the damages that they caused us when we tried to speak out and they prevented us from doing that, or they hurt us, or they intimidated us, from feeling free to come and express ourselves, which is something that our Constitution guarantees. So we have invited people who have been thinking about this for the last year to actually take their concerns and their complaints, put them on paper, and take them to the city with us on December 1st at 11 a.m. We're going to be gathering at 3rd and Yesler. We're going to be then moving over to the city offices and the county offices where they accept those forms. We're going to be handing them over. And then we will follow up. Potentially some people may choose to follow up with lawsuits if that's necessary. Others may simply work with the city to try and figure out what's the best way to compensate. But we're doing this because if we cannot, as a people of Seattle and all the people that came to Seattle, be allowed to speak out against or for the things that we believe in, we can't have a society that's one that we are proud of. It's one we can't function in the way we say we want to function. It ties in very closely to what we see with the WTO, where it is it's not transparent, it is not open to listening to dialogue, it only listens to the people that are sitting at the table. We, the people, need to be able to have that right to speak out, whether it's in the streets or whether it's in teach-ins, whatever it is. And so one other thing that I would mention is that we're inviting people to come and speak to some lawyers, because this is we are doing something that's a legal way of getting redress, and people may need some help. So on the 29th of the month, this Wednesday at 6 o'clock, some lawyers are going to be coming to help us figure out how to maybe complete those forms in the best sort of way so that we can really be effective in the way that we ask the city to do this. And I'd like to actually turn the podium over for a moment or two to Scott McClay, who, like myself, was out speaking against the way the United States works within the WTO, the way corporations rule the WTO, and some of the things that actually happened to him that last year. He's one of many. We have some press packets that I'll offer to you later that have some examples of other people that may be filing claims who are willing to talk to the press about their situations, the kinds of things we're trying to ask the city to be accountable for. So, Scott?
Last year, I was out in the streets protesting the WTO. On Wednesday, my affinity group and myself went down to the steelworkers' rally, which was held down at the pier on the waterfront. We were in solidarity with the steelworkers who were out on strike. I'm also in solidarity with the newspaper guild who are out on strike right now. Towards the end of that rally, a number of us decided to continue the protest and to take a march through Seattle. At that time, the no protest zone was in effect. This was Wednesday, December 1st. We were 1,500 strong, came up through the steps, I forget the exact name, Pike Place Steps, to Western, marched around. When our march hit 3rd and Pine, the police attacked it. They came up in their armored vehicles and with their armored suits, fired concussion grenades and a lot of tear gas. So many people sat down in the street. Our affinity group retreated around the corner. We were regrouping, deciding what to do, decided that we would continue to move away from the area. And at that moment at 2nd and Stewart, the armored car pulled into the intersection and without any warning fired a concussion grenade and simultaneously to that started shooting rubber bullets. I and other members of the Finney group were on the sidewalk. I was hit 4 times in the back of the leg with rubber bullets, which were somewhat painful, left bruises for well over a week that were sore, and was exposed to tear gas both in the initial firing and as we continued to move down the street, more tear gas was fired. Across from the street was a person in a motorized wheelchair. I saw a tear gas canister whiz by them, and they were going full speed to get out of the area. At no time were we warned that we had to disperse. At no time did the police give us any way to disperse. I feel like our protest march up until we were attacked was entirely peaceful. We were a block outside of the no protest zone when we were attacked. We were exercising our constitutional rights to free speech and to protest both the WTO and the no protest zone that was totally unconstitutional. And we were totally attacked. The police did not engage in any kind of systematic way of informing us that they viewed our march as illegal and that we should do such and such. All they did was attack us. And as people retreated, the police continued to attack us. There are hundreds, there were 1,500 people there, are probably 1,500 stories. My affinity group was about 12 that day. Most of us stayed together, but several were separated and were faced much more fearful situations than we faced. And you might remember at the end of that march, a number of people were arrested, ended up being arrested down at the Labor Temple as they were following police instructions to leave the area. The police then cordoned them off and arrested them. So this was basically a police state attack on a peaceful march to totally disrupt it. And at no time was it treated in a respectful manner to say, you can't do this, and negotiations occur, what we might have been able to do. So I'm filing a claim with the city. I'm not at all interested in personally getting money back. I am interested in holding the city accountable. I have not seen anything in the past year that indicates to me that the city is going to change in any substantive way how they deal with protests. The past 10 days or so show that they've, in fact, learned the wrong lesson. The past week we've seen posturing by Shell and others that they will arrest people without permits downtown. I view this as a tactic of intimidation, just like the attack last year. So the city's going in the wrong direction. Hopefully by a mass filing of claims, we can put monetary pressure on the city to actually learn the right lesson, which is that our constitutional rights must be respected. And in fact, this city, in typical situations, is a decent city. It's better than others I've lived in. We protest very often, and unpermitted marches are escorted by the police. They don't attempt to break us up. Happens over and over again. We meet, we march, we do not have a permit, and the police escort us and attempt to make sure that the traffic is stopped and that we're safe. They do not attack us. So why did they attack us last year? Why are they intimidating us this year?
Okay, so we're seeing a little pattern here. We got global repression and we've got local repression. Let's see if there's a little more pattern. Phil Barriano is going to speak next. He's going to talk to us about biotechnology. He's a professor at the University of Washington, and he's with a really neat name thing called Washington Biotechnology Action Council. Phil, please, thank you.
I brought my WTO little thing since I was a registered delegate at the second ministerial in Geneva, as well as at this one. And that leads me to the theme of what I want to talk about, and that is that there is a pattern going on that most of the media in this country is totally missed, which is what I call an inside-outside kind of pattern, where citizen organizations are working in conjunction with governmental groups in international fora. We saw that, of course, clearly in The Hague recently with the climate talks, to try and effectuate change, working against the great obstructors to any of the positive change that's needed, particularly the United States government and its Canadian government and their allies and the corporations. So I want to talk about the spirit of Seattle from a year ago, and I want to talk about one of our victories. People need to be more willing to claim victories than they are. And 2 months after Seattle, in Montreal, was revived the negotiations on what is called the Biosafety Protocol. The Biosafety Protocol was an attempt to regulate genetically engineered organisms that are transferred in international commerce. It had been in negotiating for 6 years, and it had been in negotiations for 6 years and had been stymied in Cartagena, Colombia, in February of 99 by the U.S., Canada, Australia, and three Latin American countries that they had gotten to go along with them. There was tremendous pressure during that year to try and start the negotiations again, and they were rescheduled for Montreal in January of 2000. What happened after Seattle was a real intensification of citizen interest in this. When we got to Montreal in January, there were literally thousands of people demonstrating in the streets. It was very cold. We had butterflies camped out in the snow outside of the negotiations. And we had a tremendous coordination between those of us working for NGOs, citizen organizations in UN speak, and delegations who were sympathetic to what we were trying to do. Now, and we got, at 5 o'clock in the morning on January 29th, a protocol in which, on many of the crucial issues, the U.S. lost. And I say that with a great measure of satisfaction. So, for example, the protocol as an environmental organization is, by its own language, not subservient to WTO. This is a tremendous breakthrough. A tremendous breakthrough, which relates to many of the things that Sally and others have been talking about, the disgust of citizens around the world that their hard-fought environmental and other kinds of standards are all of a sudden going to be suppressed and obliterated by these commercial interests. And the statement in the preamble of the Biosafety Protocol is a very clear expression that that will not be tolerated in that agreement. And we hope this sets a pattern for the future. Organizing on issues of genetically engineered food, genetically engineered organisms, human genetic engineering is intense, it's international, and it involves people who are both delegates to these international meetings and ordinary citizens like those people in this room and in this city. And it is one of the most exciting phenomena which I feel was exemplified at WTO and which has not been adequately recognized or understood, particularly by the media, who is fixated on certain themes and not looking at what's really going on. Now, I don't want to suggest that there is, in all instances, a unity of position between citizen activists and, let's say, people from third world countries, which there clearly was in the protocol negotiations. So we are well aware, I hope, that at the WTO, where many people in the street were talking about strong labor and environmental issues, many third world countries' delegations were raising concerns about the imposition of U.S. or Western environmental and labor standards on the rest of the world. These are real issues that we need to understand, that we need to work out in a real context, and which I have no doubt that with any kind of modicum of openness and so forth, are issues that could be discussed and be resolved. So I'm not trying to present a simplistic picture which says there's automatically an identity of interest. But what I am trying to say is that the old patterns in which Western, in our terminology, or Northern, in the terminology of most third world countries, Northern cultures are to automatically be imposed on other societies, so that U.S. notions of patenting, which were decided 5-4 by the Supreme Court, could cover living organisms, are somehow going to be imposed on the rest of the world. People may have noticed how many signs there were in the streets in Seattle a year ago objecting to patents on life and to genetically modified foods. So the inside-outside strategy was, I think, very well exemplified, again, by an issue which most of the media has totally missed or ignored, and that was the proposal leading up to the Seattle ministerial, or the non-ministerial, which was put forward by Canada, Japan, with U.S. support, that the WTO establish a working group to deal with issues of biotechnology. Now, this was something that those of us dealing with these concerns opposed, and most third world countries and most of the European Union, where, by the way, citizen activism on this issue has made those governments take progressive positions, because it was an attempt to circumvent the protocol negotiations, which were being handled under the United Nations, under the Convention on Biological Diversity. The protocol is a sub-treaty. What the U.S., Canada, and Japan were trying to do was to be able to go back into the discussions 2 months hence in Montreal and say, well, this is all being taken care of under WTO that with this new working group, so there's nothing for us to talk about. And, of course, in the WTO, the U.S. has much more leverage than it has in the protocol negotiations, where it's not even a party formally because the U.S. Senate refuses to ratify the Convention on Biological Diversity. The ability to stop that effort in Seattle was, from the point of view of those of us concerned about issues of genetically engineered food and the fact that they're not being adequately safety tested or labeled for consumers to have a right to know what they're eating, genetically engineered organisms and people who are concerned about animal welfare and health, human genetic engineering and the like, and the commoditization of genes and genomes, including humans, that was a major set of victories that we really need to proclaim and be aware of. One, stopping the attempt by WTO elements to set up a biosafety, in quotes, mechanism that would circumvent the convention, and two, the victory in Montreal in getting a protocol. I actually leave in 10 days to go to Montpellier, France, where the first implementation meeting for the protocol will occur. Something on the order of about 75 or 80 countries have signed the protocol, and although only two or three have yet formally ratified it, which is the second step where the parliament agrees and everything, the first one of which was Bulgaria, of all interesting things. Let me just make one or two other quick points. And what did we win? What did we win from the point of view of genetic engineering, which is becoming and biotech, which is becoming a major issue? The protocol makes it clear that genetically modified organisms are not the same as organisms which traditional biology have modified. So the wheat, the corn, the rice, the hybrids and everything that exist are all the products of working within a single species and interbreeding very selectively and so forth. Genetically modified organisms are something different, something that no farmer, no act of nature could bring about, which is in fact transposing genes from one species into another. And the protocol is by its existence recognition that under international law, genetically modified organisms are not the same as traditionally hybrid things. This is very important because we're always told by the lackeys, the biologists, and so forth employed by the corporations that they don't understand why people are concerned because these organisms have been changed all the time by farmers and everything. Hey, we understand that this is a totally different thing. They do too, by the way, when they go to the patent office and make the claim that it's totally new and novel, all right? So they're talking out of both sides of their mouth. We're talking only out of one side of our mouth. Secondly, the biosafety protocol embodies what is known as the precautionary principle, an evolving and extremely important aspect of international law, which says when one is dealing with risk, if you don't know the details of the risk and there's possibility of serious substantial harm, what you should do is to be prudent. i.e. look before you leap, or an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, etc. We have all these folk wisdom things about it. Now it's coming to international law. Again, over the determined opposition of the U.S. in particular, the countries of the world, this is enshrined in the Treaty of Union of the European Union, but this is the first general international law that embodies it. By the way, the U.S. domestic law, for example, FDA approval of drugs, is based on the precautionary principle. It's the economic interest behind genetic engineering now, the Monsantos of the world and so forth, who don't want recognition of the precautionary principle. That was a tremendous victory. And the third one is that the U.S., Canada, and Australia, who are the main breeders of genetically engineered grains and who ship them out as commodities, did not want commodities to be covered by the protocol, and commodities are covered by the protocol. It's not just small shipments of, you know, some kind of unique apple or something like that. It's going to be the tons and tons of stuff which U.S. farmers want to start sending around the world. So I just want to make that point. And one last thing, part of the WTO is a provision called TRIPS, trade-related intellectual property rights. The TRIPS provision, by its own words, is supposed to be reviewed this year. The U.S. in particular and other governments are stonewalling and saying, well, we'll just discuss the implementation but not the basic language. The African delegations led by Kenya have drafted a position paper which most of the third world is supporting. There is, in fact, right this moment, an effort going on around the world for citizen organizations to sign on to that and back that, and that is going to be one of the next upcoming struggles on this front. So genetically engineered issues played an important role last year, and they continue to do so. I'd be happy to take a couple of questions if you'd like. I don't know any of the current details on Bovet. He was found guilty and had a sentence. I guess he's appealing it. I don't know. He did bring over fabulous cheese. I don't know if you got a chance to try. The Starlink corn, which is the corn that contains genetic recombinations that was not approved by the FDA for human consumption, but has been found in the taco shells and everything, is actually appearing in lots of surprising places. There were just some emails yesterday. And this is because, in fact, I should say this very clearly, every one of the cautions and concerns which environmental groups, citizen groups, consumer groups have raised have been proven to be accurate and reasonable, either when research is funded, and very little research into the risks is funded, which is one of the major issues, so that the governments and corporations can say, well, you haven't proved that it's dangerous, because, of course, they don't look. Don't look, don't find, you know, it's that kind of thing. Or by nature, and in this case, the drift of pollen, okay? You plant genetically engineered fields, and guess what? Birds pick up the grain and carry it far distances, and some of it drops out of their beak, or it comes out in their excrement, which happens, which nature has intended for it to happen, so that it starts someplace new and so forth. So the Starlink gene is turning up in some very surprising places. This is also, of course, an indictment on the U.S. regulatory system, which is a non-regulatory system for genetically engineered foods, okay, very explicitly, because we don't have any segregation, we don't have labeling, we don't have tracking, we don't have monitoring, and so we don't put in place mechanisms to say, if we're going to plant this stuff, how can we be precautionary and take care? So here's this stuff which has elements that seem like it might be allergenic to individuals, which is now appearing, and you can't know about it. Any corn product you buy in QFC or in Safeway and so forth could contain it, and you can't know about it, and they probably don't even know about it. It's no labeling. Yeah. Well, Sally's more expert than I am, and other people here may be more expert than I am on the actual origin of this, but one of the major focus points of the Uruguay round was to move beyond tariff barriers and talk about the fact that there are other non-tariff barriers to trade. There's actually a provision in the treaty which is called non-tariff barriers. So, and of course this is obviously true, even to those of us who feel that the current regime is oppressive, all right? That, of course, you can have things other than tariffs that are barriers to trade. And so the claim is made that many of these supposed health and safety regulations are in fact protectionist. And, you know, I'm sure there are some examples in the past. That has nothing to do with whether current concerns about hormone-laced beef or antibiotic resistance markers in genetically engineered food, when we have a major world health problem about the growth of antibiotic resistance, etc., whether those are or are not real issues. I believe they are real issues, that they're not protectionist. I don't for a minute believe that the European Union has adopted its rules on labeling of genetically engineered food for protectionist reasons. They've adopted it because no government will be able to exist in Europe which doesn't do this because of the strength of the Green parties. By the way, one might mention that the use of proportional representation in European governments means that issues and concerns like these environmental ones become reflected in real political policy making and are legitimized by discussions in the parliaments and so forth, which is not true here. We're now all concerned because of the events in Florida, and I won't go off, about the difficulties of the winner-take-all system. But one of the difficulties of the winner-take-all system, which the Florida fiasco shows, is that, in fact, issues represented by a substantial portion of the population, as much as 49.99%, might, in fact, be totally suppressed. That's not true in a proportional representation system. So European governments are much more sensitive to their citizens. It's a much fuller democratic system. So I don't think that those things are, in fact, trade-related barriers. The pressures for them have not come from the European industries that want to hide behind them. The pressures of them have come from consumers, environmental groups, safety groups, health groups, and so forth. Thank you very much.
So we are seeing a pattern here. Sally was talking about global domination. Erica was talking about personal domination. Now, Phil shares with us about, you know, what life is made of in itself. It's a big issue. And with that, we have Ben White, the inventor of the turtles from last year. He's going to give us an update on what's been happening since last year. Ben is with the Animal Welfare Institute. And welcome, Ben White.
Welcome to the revolution. Looks like it might be televised after all, eh? Turtle shell's gotten a little weary over the last year. It's not only went through days of rain here and police batons, it also went to Washington, D.C. to the demonstration against the IMF and World Bank. I'm international coordinator for an animal protection group called Animal Welfare Institute. Part of my job is going to international fora which protect animals, for example, the International Whaling Commission and the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. And part of my work is lobbying Congress to try to get laws passed to protect animals. And one of the things that brought me to become active opposing WTO was the realization that you can work all you want to get laws passed, for example, the Dolphin Protection Act, which was passed in 1991, only to see that stymied and overturned. Here's a law that came in with overwhelming public support, because over 7 million dolphins had died in tuna nets. And when that law came in, Mexico filed a grievance under GATT, and which now has been absorbed by WTO, that was an unfair trade restriction of their dolphin-deadly tuna. So it brought to the fore that we really have lost our sovereignty. We've lost our ability to make laws. What WTO tells us is that we have no right to stand up and protect wildlife on Earth, even if that's our want as a people, and that we will be stymied in that attempt. So last year, we put 240 people dressed as sea turtles on the streets of Seattle to make our statement and to impersonate them, if you will, that we have a right to make our own laws in this country, and that WTO will not succeed in taking away our right to do that. And what happened last year, and it caught a lot of people by surprise, but I've been building a little log cabin in the woods and a burning brush, and I realized that when you have a smoldering fire and put brush on it, it ignites much more powerfully, and it's harder to put out than, say, igniting a pile of brush with gasoline. And what we had here was long smoldering fires from way back to when the labor was crushed by Pinkertons way back to, this really is a movement born of blood from lots of directions. You have dead turtles and dolphins on the beaches. You have lots and lots of people from all over the place come together. It's born of the frustration of a whole youth that sees no alternative given to them as a future except to increase commercialism and spiritual impoverishment. And they flooded the streets to say that is not so, and that they actually stand up for something much greater. One of the things that seems to be assumed for a long time of American citizens, as long as we have access to unlimited stuff, we'll be happy. What happened here was the message that no, that isn't so, that it does actually matter to us where it comes from. What is the process of getting it to our stores and to us? What happens to the people who are involved in producing it? What happens to the raw materials themselves? How is it produced? How are they wiping out the earth and polluting in order to do it? Why is our American industries flooding to northern Mexico and to the maquiladoras along the front and making essentially a 1,000-mile-long love canal? It's also born of love. And that's what, to me, was one of the most powerful evidence in the streets 1 year ago. And it was probably one of the greatest shames that very little of the media ever picked up on that. They showed the same pictures over and over and over and over and never caught even the whiff of the power and the allegiance and the devotion between us all on the streets. You had everything from Asian rice farmers to organic farmers here to human rights activists, to social justice, to animal protection people. And what did we find out? We found out we share the same common enemy. Who is that enemy? It's corporate power, which is working hard, secretly, behind the scenes, with our governments, paying them off to take away our right to control our own destinies and our lives. And it comes very, very personal, very intrinsic. It comes down to, as Phil pointed out, what food we eat, how we protect our families, where we go to war. What happens to our air? Right now, do we have uncontrolled corporate power which does what they want and causes global warming and wrecks a place? Is that what happens, or do we put ourselves in control? What we also realize with our common enemy is the power of a good foil, a point that may be important now coming into a probable Bush presidency. The power of organizing ourselves around a real and definable evil. And what we had is linkage between the turtles and the Teamsters, between those from Flint, Michigan, to Taipei, all over the world. We have here, and I'm just going to have one mention of it, we have two guys running for president, both of which have no right to do that, both of which have endorsed GATT and WTO, both of which essentially disenfranchise all people, have both violated their vow to protect the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. What we have here today is no less than the continuation and the invigoration of a global populist democratic movement, which has been prompted by a global corporatist power movement. And this is, it is here, it is growing, and it is real. And it's the most exciting movement I've ever been connected to, and I've been connected with six or seven in the last 30 years of my activism. We have learned that in the process of WTO, we learned a lot of things. One of them was we are far more powerful than we think we are. Another one is we uncovered the Achilles heel of corporate power, which is what? It comes down to the fact, and Monsanto is a good example, is we have to buy their crap for them to live. We don't buy their crap, they die. They also can't force us to do it. So the more we get out our word to base locally and to pull away the energy from corporations that hurt us, the stronger we get and the weaker they get. And there's nothing they can do about it. After Seattle, things didn't go away. We went from place to place to place. It has never been the same. It's like we set off this little bomb on an acupuncture point of the world economy, and it has not changed. WTO cannot get themselves together anymore. They're afraid to show their face. They expect the next WTO ministerial to be in somewhere like perhaps Bahrain or Oman, where they can seize down the streets and make sure that they arrest anybody who comes up. One of the things that we're up against, you probably heard the quote come up lots during the Nader campaign, and it occurred to me the other day that it all happened on one day here. And it's a Gandhian quote that said, first they ignored us, then they laughed at us. What's the next one? Then they beat us, then we won. That happened in one day here. And believe it, we did win. Because in a way it's very comparable to the crumbling of the British Raj in India, which Gandhi was talking about. We have a crumbling Raj system here, which says we as people have no right to determine our own destiny. Want to bet? Watch us. One of the things that I want you to see is what happened here a year ago, despite all the planning of big groups and all the heavy thinkers. When it came down to it, who caused the shutdown of the WTO? It wasn't the big groups. It wasn't the heavy thinkers. It was the kids. You know those kids? The Northwest, patchouli-wearing, ear-pierced, cheek-pierced, dreadlocked. Those are the kids who came out and did it. They seized down the streets, and I honor them for that. They had the courage, and I saw great love and great courage. What do you do to insurmountable, powerful, aggressive, violent evil? You look it in the face. You stand in front of it. You say, do your damnedest, sort of like a turtle would. That's all I have for today. If you all have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Yes, sir. Well, that rages on, right? Right now, the dispute specifically which came out was WTO said that our law protecting sea turtles that required any country importing shrimp in this country use turtle excluder nets, that is still under contention. And they're still trying to knock down that part of our Endangered Species Act that does that. Turtles continue to die worldwide. One of the reasons we picked on turtles as a good symbol for this whole effort is it's one of the most successful life forms on Earth. It's hundreds of millions of years old. Sea turtles are about 90 million years old. And every single species of the 9 species of sea turtles are endangered. Why are they endangered? They're endangered by rapacious industrial fishing techniques that don't give a damn. And they're endangered by us, by the shrimp that come from them. Has it done them any good? I don't know. What it did do is the turtles, for some reason, became the darling of media all around the world. There were dozens of cartoons, including Oliphant, all kinds of people. First thing I heard as feedback from WTO was a friend of mine who was in Malaysia, and he heard, hey, I heard about your turtles on the streets. One thing that has always happened from now on, what I was trying to do with the turtles, I believe, was succeeded, and that is to link WTO with the demolition of wildlife protection laws. That happened, no question about it. It's a long progress. This whole thing is not a destination, but it's a path. We always have work to do. We are in the middle of the Kali Yuga. You know, this is the end days, and it is a tough fight. In the crunch of corporate power, what goes first is the wild and the wonderful and the magnificent. That becomes just stuff. What we find out in all the forum I go to around the world is the argument given by corporate power is that wildlife is just stuff to be used by people. It's called the wise use argument, now being morphed into sustainable use. We still have right now we have off our coast Japan increasing their quote-unquote scientific whaling, now in the North Pacific, going after Brutus and sperm whales, which are on our endangered species list. The United States filed a grievance. They said, this goes against all international laws. Japan says, go screw yourself. So what they also said, you try to stop us from doing this, and we will file an objection, guess where? With the World Trade Organization. That is their comeback. For any scoundrel, that is their refuge right now for violence against the earth. What, to me, as an activist, the best we can come up with is the polarization of the arguments. Make it clear. That's why I voted for Nader, even if it means Bush coming in. I think Bush will cause the greatest outburst of democratic movement and populism this country has seen. It's easy to downplay and ignore the immensity and the power of what has gone on here in the last year. As an activist, I can see it. It's like nothing before. It has breathed fresh air into our sails. And we are not going to be stopped, and we're not going back in the box. Yes? Yeah, it's kind of an interesting story because one of the most successful environmental movements of our time was the bringing the Dolphin Protection Act. And how did that come about? It came about because millions of school children wrote letters saying, why are you allowing dolphins to be killed for tuna fish? And if you keep on, we're not going to buy tuna fish. So what happened is it brought incredible pressure on Starkist, Bumblebee, and Chicken of the Sea, who import 95% of all tuna in this country. The final straw was when a friend of mine went to a girls' finishing school in Ireland to speak about tuna dolphin, as all of us were going around doing. And unbeknownst to him, one of the people in the audience was the daughter of F.J. O'Reilly, who was president of Heinz Corporation, who produced Starkist tuna. And she calls up her daddy that night and says, Daddy, are you killing dolphins? A week later, he held a press conference saying he was not going to do that anymore. Within a day, the other companies flipped. And the story since then is a little interesting. I'll tell it to you really quick. One of the things some of the toes we were stepping on when we brought in the Dolphin Protection Act in 1991 that we didn't understand was the groups that had been buying up almost every single tuna processor and tuna fishing company in Mexico, and it was the Cali Cartel. They were running cocaine, and still are, on tuna boats. They call it atún blanco. So they lodged an enormous lobbying campaign with the U.S. government to overturn the Dolphin Protection Act to free up their ships for running the dolphin deadly tuna and the atún blanco on up the West Coast. Okay? One tuna boat alone, the Natalie One, was seized with $1 billion of cocaine on it. It is part of the stitching together all over the world right now of wildlife trade and drug trade. And sure enough, 97, 98, they did turn over the Dolphin Protection Act and called it, what they call it, the International Dolphin Conservation Act, which we immediately dubbed the Dolphin Death Act, which says that dolphin label, dolphin safe label, can mean dolphin tuna caught by chasing, surrounding, and netting tuna. I mean dolphin. That's how they used to catch them. That's what was done away with. You can't do that technique without killing dolphins. Our Secretary of Commerce, who was William J. Daley, by the way, who is Gore's campaign director, he said, yes, this is okay. Change the label. Our strength is so good, though, and the boycott threat is so strong. All the major canners say the government can do what they want. We're going to adhere to the original definition of dolphin safe, which means you don't harass, chase, or kill dolphins in order to catch your tuna. It's just one tiny little bit of the trade question which highlights how this impacts on wildlife to a huge degree. And we're still holding our own. We've been beating the feds in court every time on this tuna dolphin issue. And so far, despite the WTO, despite the Mexicans, despite everybody, tuna sold in this country is still dolphin safe. Any other questions? Yes? Yeah, right now, wise use, the wise use movement came up, and it's important to realize with this, it came up really out of Bellevue. A guy named Ron Arnold and his folks a few years ago cooked up this idea, and they went to huge extractive industries like Weyerhaeuser and say, look, you've been fighting your battles wrong. Instead of showing up there and fighting for corporate profit, bring up your employees and say, stop us from cutting trees and you're putting Joe Smith out of work and his poor family who's behind him. Use the people who work for you to stand up for the industry. And that was very, very successful. Now, and their argument essentially is this. Look, human beings are part of nature. What we do is natural, too. Even if it causes extinctions, that's the way it goes. We're just part of the weft of life. And if that's how it happens, that's how it happens. And right now, increasingly, the United States, in fact, I've talked to Al Gore. He's a wise user through and through. He believes that, and a lot of people do, that the problem is not using wildlife, say it be it elephants, whales, old growth forests. It is how you do it, and as long as you do it a little bit at a time and manage it, then we'll be okay. As an activist watching this happen, I don't believe it. It gets whittled away piece by piece and we lose it all. The argument basically boils down to this. Here's a chunk of wilderness. I want to develop it all. You want to save it all. What's the compromise position? We cut it in half. We develop half, we save half. Next year, my brother comes along, he wants to develop that half. So we keep on halving it, halving it, halving it, halving it, until it's gone. My own feeling is, unless we put up brick walls to the decimation of the wild and the wonderful, with 6 billion people, it all goes away. Any more? Thanks for your time.